Hi, everybody. Today's Wednesday, October 30th, and we have Colonel Daniel Davis with us to talk about what's going on in the Middle East and maybe about Ukraine as well. Welcome back, Colonel.
Hey, glad to be back, Nima. Thanks for having me.
And let's start with the latest attack, the attack, Israeli attack on Iran. There are a lot of rumors out there. Some Israelis are talking that they have destroyed all the air defense system of Iran. The way that Iranians are talking about this attack, it seems that it was limited in their mind. When you put these two pictures that are totally different together, what's your understanding on what has happened on that day, on that night?
My guess is it's somewhere in the middle. It's clear that Israel did do some damage. I mean, we have these satellite images. There's a pretty detailed list of those in the Washington Post. I think it was last night is when it came out. And there's unequivocally some damage, but it's really hard to know, if not impossible, for some of the claims that Israel's been saying, for them to be validated. You know, they said they have devastated their ability to create weapons. And according to the Washington Post, you know, now then they're not able to make rocket motors. Well, that implies that you know all of the systems that the Iranians have, that you know where all of their warehouses are and that you know where they make different components. And I doubt seriously that we have that good of intelligence or further that Iran would make itself, a single point of failure by only making one building that does rocket motors and only one building that does this, et cetera. Unless they're just very foolish, most places will have redundancy so that they're not that limited, so that if one building gets knocked out, you know, the whole thing comes to a stop. So I doubt that. I don't have any personal firsthand knowledge myself, but just knowing the Iranians the way that I do and the way have performed and the risk that they know they have from Israel is that they almost certainly would have had redundancy in their systems. We also don't know from those photographs, you know, exactly how much damage was done. Was it a complete destruction? Was it harmed? We just don't know any of those things. And Israel can't figure it out just from looking at satellite imagery. You have to have more knowledge about things on the ground. Now, at the same time, you also can't say, well, all the Iranian air defenses worked, because clearly they didn't. But we do have some video evidence that some of them did. So I think that a lot of things were intercepted. And especially if what the Israelis said was true, then they had 100 aircraft were involved in this and only this relatively small number of targets were damaged. And that does imply that they weren't that effective, because when that leaked information came out a week or so before all this happened, this top secret American document described all the preparation and the number of aircraft and the type of missiles that were going to be used, et cetera. Apparently all that was accurate, and that is in fact what was used. And if there was that much ordnance and that many aircraft involved in such a small number of damage was done, then apparently the Iranian air defenses were modestly successful. And I guess that's about the most you could say of it right now. But the bottom line to the whole thing is that at least up to this point, it was not so big that it has prompted an immediate response from the Iranian side. So it remains to be seen where we go next.
And what's amazing, Colonel, that right after this attack, the Iranian stock market was doing great. And because I follow what's going on in Iran and the stock market and how does it work. Whenever we are hearing something big coming to Iran and something big is going to happen between Iran and the United States, some conflict in the Middle East, the stock market just going up and down. But right after this attack, it's just going up and everything was good in just growing in the stock market. That was shocking for me. And on the other hand, in your opinion, in terms of this attack, Israelis are talking about that their aircrafts, their fighter jets invaded Iranian airspace. How about that? Do we have any sort of information on that?
The best that I can come up with is that Israeli aircraft stayed about 100 miles away from Iranian airspace. And that makes sense, because Iran does have adequate, if not great, air defense. And a lot of this is not just to shoot down missiles, but to shoot down enemy jets. And if Israel has the range on their weapon systems, much like what the Russians do when they launch a lot of these glide bombs against Ukrainian targets, they find out what the standoff range is. And, you know, even though the Ukrainian side is limited in their air defense capacity, they do have some. And so the Russians know what they have and they stay outside of it. And it just makes sense for the Israeli side to avoid any possibility of getting their aircraft shot down. If they can still hit the targets, they'll do it from the maximum standoff range so that they don't put their jets at risk. I did see some reports out on the Western press this morning that said Israel violated Iranian airspace, but I doubt that because that would be an unnecessary risk to take. I think that may be just a lot of braggadocio to make it sound like Israel's impervious because their jets aren't. They're subject to being shot down like the aircraft of any nation.
Yeah. And how these fighters just got to the close to the border of Iran? Do you think they've used the airspace of Jordan, Iraq, and they went there? Who had provided this corridor for them?
Yeah, I mean, when you just look at a map and it's almost impossible for it to be any other way. They nearly had to have gone through Syria, through Jordan and Iraq. Otherwise, I don't think you could have even gotten there. I don't know of any other way. So whether they got permission or whether they just did it is a separate issue. Obviously, Israeli jets have been hitting targets in Syria for a long time. And so far as I'm aware, they haven't lost any jets in the process. So they apparently know where they can go there. And there were at least reports, and I've seen various comments on this, that there were some targets hit in Iraq. And in Syria. So potentially the Israeli side took after air defense sites along the corridor that they had, that they had selected out there so that they could go back and forth without any concern of getting shot down either at the location or going to and from. Some of the questions are that have not been answered, at least not authoritatively by anyone I've seen. Did the United States physically assist in aerial refueling, because the flight times are quite long and exceed the round trip capacity in the fuel tanks of most of the jets. So somebody must have done it. But we don't know. That's a kind of a mixed review there, but somebody did.
Yeah. And when you look at this attack on Iran and the way that Antony Blinken was trying to manage the situation in the Middle East in his recent visit to Israel, do you think when you look at Iranian are talking about the attack was limited, Israelis are satisfied, we have destroyed everything. Is that a win for the Biden administration?
I think that it's a win for the Biden administration in that the strike was not so big that it spawned an immediate Iranian retaliation, which could have been devastating against Israel. Iran still retains the capacity, however much their air defense radars have been hit, to unleash holy hell if they wanted to in the missiles that they could rain down on Israel. So that threat remains. But, you know, it just really looks like the Biden administration is probably has done everything they could to say, hey, just keep it kind of low for now, at least through November 5th, because they don't want anything at all to get in the way of Kamala Harris succeeding her current boss by winning on November the 5th. So it'll be interesting to see what happens afterwards. And part of that alarm bell for me went up yesterday afternoon on Fox News. Naftali Bennett was asked about some of his comments that he had made prior to the Israel's attack, their response, when he said that he thought they should go after nuclear weapons sites, the Israelis should go after energy infrastructure, et cetera. And then obviously they didn't. They didn't go after either one of those. Well, he was asked yesterday, okay, so what do you say about that? Did they just change their mind? And he says, no, that was just the beginning. We still should go after those. And until we destroy the head of the octopus, as he calls it, this is going to continue on. So and he said they should go after the nuclear sites and the Iranian regime. And I thought that was very eye-opening. It didn't get a lot of comment from the reporter, because I'm thinking, hang on, you guys just said this was a retaliation for what the Iranians did with 100 on October 1st. Now then you're talking about that there may be another one, like you may not be finished, even without a next response from the Iranian regime. And then at the United Nations Security Council, I think also on the 27th or 28th, I can't remember, Danny Danon, the Israeli ambassador also implied that this was not over and they were still going after Iran. They felt like that they had to do that. So it sounds like maybe the Biden administration was successful in getting them a hold off before the election. But one wonders, after November 5th, does the risk go back up of continued Israeli attacks?
Yeah. In this interview that you mentioned, Naftali Bennett talking about, they're going to, it seems to me that he's talking about the assassination of the Iranian leaders when he's talking about.
Straight up. He was.
And do you find this type of strategy? We've seen this in Gaza, in Lebanon, right now in Iran. In your opinion, isn't it that delusional that nobody can understand what's going on in their mind? Because even you go just assassinate the supreme leader of Iran, what's going to change in Iran? There are a lot of people that it's a country. It's not a small group of people. Even in Gaza, you were not successful with that strategy. And they're talking about this over and over. It seems that every time they're thinking of this type of strategy, it's going to achieve something.
Look, I mean, you have to look at our experience. So in 2005, we killed the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, a guy named Mousab al-Zarqawi. And what did that do? Did they get rid of Al-Qaeda in Iraq? It just morphed into ISIS. And then they had a new leader, al-Baghdadi. We took al-Baghdadi out. They just got a new one. We took, of course, bin Laden out in 2011 out of Al-Qaeda. He was replaced by al-Zawahiri. Al-Zawahiri was later killed. And then they just added somebody else. And every time you see this, and of course, with Haniyeh was assassinated, with Hezbollah leader Nasrallah was assassinated. And yet everybody keeps fighting. All of these things just keep going. It never knocks anybody out. I'm not aware of a single group where the head was killed and all of a sudden the body fell apart, because that's a gross misunderstanding of what these things are. As you said, first of all, in the case of Iran, it's a country. And are you going to suggest that if somebody assassinates the president of the United States, that America is going to fall apart? No, we got a vice president. They'll just elevate up and then somebody else moves up, et cetera. It would be no different there too. Now, maybe they have some fantasy that if the Ayatollah is taken out, then the people of Iran would say, yay, thank you, Israel. And then they would revolt and go and bring down the rest of the government. And then suddenly they would be friendly to the West or something. I suppose that's probably the most likely fantasy that they have. But the most likely realistic outcome is that it's going to bring more of the Iranian people together against the West and against Israel, and it's going to push them into getting a nuclear weapon, not going to prevent them from having one, not going to lower the risk. It's just going to elevate the risk of it. And of course, as we all know, it's an open secret, Israel has nuclear weapons. So then are they going to advance into a nuclear explosion? Are they going to advance not just from missiles, but now actually make a nuclear attack? I mean, the whole world changes in an instant that way, aside from the physical fallout that may happen on that. And everything is bad from that perspective. And if no other reason, that should lead the United States to say, y'all back the hell down, or I'm going to stop supporting you with everything, because we are not going to have this thing explode into a region-wide conflagration, which could literally change the security dynamics around the world. Once nuclear weapons are used, the next time they're used anywhere, everything for security changes everywhere else in the world, and all for the worst, I assure you.
Yeah. And they had the conflict in Gaza, and without putting an end to the conflict and having any sort of political settlement, military settlement, they went to southern part of Lebanon. And right after the southern part of Lebanon, the conflict with Iran. When you look at the Netanyahu administration and what they're looking for with this type of attitude that they're experiencing, they're showing us, how is that anything substantial in their mind to achieve? Because so far, nothing has happened in Gaza, in Lebanon, against Iran. And he's trying to convince Israelis that they're winning. And nobody knows what does that mean in his mind and in the mind of his administration.
Yeah, they do. They absolutely think that they're winning. And you know, it's not hard to, at least for the time being, to keep the Israeli people believing that, because they see all these pictures of destruction everywhere and devastation. And they see, you know, some number of drones and rockets coming back in their direction, but it's relatively contained. It's not a big issue. So, I mean, if you see your government saying we're going after your enemies, they're all coming after you, and we have to do this to protect ourselves. And you see, you know, buildings being wiped out. You see these huge explosions in Beirut or everywhere throughout southern Lebanon or the West Bank that's going on. You can keep the image going up of that you're succeeding. But that's only temporary, because I can just tell you authoritatively that Israel is embarking itself against the Houthis in Yemen, against the Hamas in the Gaza Strip, against the Palestinians in the West Bank, against Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, and against Iran, you know, north of that, that there is no military solution to any of them, any of them. And so, Yemen, how many years did Saudi Arabia try to compel them with American help? They never did. They never completely shut them down. We've been now in the Red Sea for how many months have we been trying to, without success? Now Israel itself is also doing on that, blowing up lots of stuff, but they don't have a military end. They don't have an objective that can be attained with military force. They just blow stuff up, which keeps the conflict going. And unless they're going to physically eliminate everybody in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, and either kill them all or shove them out of the country in some way. I used to think that was self-evidently not true. They would never go that far. I don't know that anymore. It could be that is their place. We know for a fact that right now they're in the process of physically clearing everybody out of the northern part of Gaza. They claim it's to find Hamas, and then once they clear it, then they'll let people back in, even though they're destroying every capacity to live in there, so that I don't know what people would go back to, but it's certainly plausible that they're physically in the process of eliminating everybody in the Gaza Strip. And you just can't succeed with that, because there is a limit. I mean, you're already seeing a lot of revolt among many in the West already for what's happened up to this point. And whether they think they can do it or not, I don't think that the rest of the world will sit by and say, no, we're going to allow you to physically commit genocide and ethnic cleansing in front of all of our eyes. There's going to come an end to it, and then Israel's not going to be able to capacitate it. That's just there. And the West Bank, there's 5 million Palestinians living there. I mean, where would they go? What would they do with that? I mean, you just can't mass murder that many people or physically get them out, because the world just won't stand for it. And then the military task alone in southern Lebanon is enormous, and Israel's taken a lot of casualties so far. There's a move reported right now that Brett McGurk and another American guy is trying to create a 60-day ceasefire. Israel has been against all that from the beginning, but they may say okay here because they need a retool to figure out what they're doing, because they're suffering so many casualties and have taken such a small amount of territory, and there's so much more left on there. They're claiming, and to some credibility, that if they get this 60-day ceasefire, it's so that the Hezbollah would willingly move up to the Litani River and clear out everything. And of course, if Israel can get all that territory without fighting for it, they would do that. But I doubt seriously that the Hezbollah side is going to say, sure, we'll just give up and let you have everything and leave half the country. And even then, that would delay it. But if they don't do that, it's, I think, militarily unattainable with the number of forces that Israel has, the damage it's already doing to their economy, et cetera. And all of that is different or accepted from the adding the Iran piece to it. So if you want to go and add that to it, I mean, it would be catastrophic for Israel. Ergo, there is no military solution in any one of these places. And at some point, that's going to be self-evident, but they're not going to win and they're not going to achieve their outcome, which is peace for Israel.
It seems that Biden thought that the attack in the southern part of Lebanon would help his position. But as you mentioned, it seems a trap for his administration in Lebanon. But at the end of the day, do you think, are they courageous enough to retreat from Lebanon, or they're going to stay there?
I mean, I would be shocked if they do. If the McGurk and the rest of this crew and the Israelis and the Lebanese government people they're talking to, if they can somehow talk Hezbollah out of continuing to fight and leave, I would just be absolutely shocked. I you can't dismiss the possibility. Because they could also view it as a tactical move that says, hey, you know, we've taken so much heat and so many losses and casualties. We need to, you know, retool and fight it, live to fight another day. That's possible. I'd give that less than a 10% chance, though, because I think that they can see that Israel has overextended it in all these other places. And if they keep the fight going, they can eventually bleed Israel dry, even though it'll come at the cost of a lot of Hezbollah and Hamas blood. So I can't say for confident one way, because I don't know what the calculus is on the minds of the Hezbollah fighters. But my guess is that they're going to continue to fight, because otherwise they basically make it easier for Israel. And I don't see them doing that.
The other point in Lebanon is that the United States is trying to do some sort of political moves in Lebanon to isolate Hezbollah. In your opinion, that would work, because this was the same policy for such a long time. Right now, with this assassination of the head of Hezbollah, Nasrallah, and his commanders, and we have a new Secretary General of Hezbollah announced yesterday. And he was talking today, and he said that we're going to fight for years, for months, for weeks to come. We are prepared to do that. And how about Lebanon? What's going on, in your opinion, in Lebanon? And is that achievable, what the United States is trying to do politically in Lebanon to isolate Hezbollah?
Well, okay, so his comments, or I had not actually not seen those. I saw that he was going to speak, but I hadn't seen the contents of it, so appreciate that. That tends to facilitate or support my 90% probability that they're going to continue to fight, and that they're aware of the costs, they're aware of the casualties, and that they're going to be willing to pay them. It doesn't seem reasonable to me to suspect that he would make that statement and then immediately say, okay, actually, never mind, we're going to go ahead and withdraw and have this reduction and all this kind of stuff. So I think pretty unlikely to happen. And so that implies then that this could be just another example of the loss of American political and diplomatic heft that we're apparently publicly, or at least it's been publicly announced, that the U.S. ambassador to Lebanon is actively trying to get them to either quit backing Hezbollah or to actively go against them or to get them to quit, whatever. And if that doesn't happen, then of course, that just makes us look really feckless and weak, that we can't, you know, even a government as weak as the Lebanese government and as poor as they are, that we, you know, the ambassador to the United States of America can't get them to do anything that we want, and that they're going to continue fighting, or at least turning a blind eye to Hezbollah. And look, you got to look at what's, I mean, even from their perspective, the Lebanese side, I mean, it's not like they love Hezbollah and that they wouldn't have changed it if they could have. I mean, they, I'm sure, would love to have control of their country, to have control of the security forces, but they can't take it. They hadn't been able to in the past. Why does anyone think they're going to have it now? And to me, it seems the idea that the Lebanese military and government is going to turn against Hezbollah and potentially fight them, that just strikes me as exceptionally unrealistic, because basically the effect would be that the Lebanese government would be joining with Israel, to go against the Hezbollah. And I just can't imagine that would happen.
We had the Bill Burns together with the head of Mossad in Qatar, talking with Qataris about what's going on in Gaza. And do you think that they're still hoping that they can achieve something before 2024, or as this presidential election is going on in the United States, that would maybe help the Democratic Party in the process of election?
I mean, you really can't detach it, because the current administration is in the election, so they always want things to go back in their favor. I don't know that they're actively making some of those comments and taking some of these actions specifically to win the election. because I mean, it's if they are, they're doing a really bad job of it, because they're not helping out their cause, because there's a real issue within the Democratic Party. You know, the issue in the U.S. is one of the best ways to win an election is to unify your base and to get them to go out and vote in large numbers. So even if you don't get the so-called people in the middle, if you get enough of your own side and making sure you get, you know, a high percentage of them voting, then you'll win the election anyway, because the other side probably won't have as many. That's the objective anyway. And the Democrats have a problem in that a fairly large minority of their voting population are very much pro-Palestinian people. It's not anti-Semitic like some people want to accuse them of being. They're just very pro the innocent people of Palestine paying for what's happening here, and they want to see the government doing something to take care of that instead of just reflexively doing whatever Israel tells them. And so you've seen Kamala Harris and many of the other people supporting the campaign. They give these words out that, well, it matters how Israel does this and they have to do better. But there's no action behind it. And I don't know how much that's going to move, that voting block, but it seems unlikely to me that they're going to move against it. But they have to be careful, whether it's Bill Burns or anyone else, that they don't go too far pro Israel, that they alienate and basically give a green light for them to kill more Palestinian people. Because that's not going to help them at the ballot box. But at this point, I think most people in the Democratic Party are just going to, hold their nose and pull that lever for the Democratic nominee no matter what, because they don't like the Republican nominee very much.
Considering what has happened during more than a year in Gaza, do you think that the Biden administration still having any sort of leverage on Netanyahu?
No. No, I don't see any evidence that they have any leverage on Netanyahu. They might have a little bit when it came to Iran, because it looks like we probably did talk them off of a big strike, at least before November 5th. Everything could change after that. We'll have to wait and see how that plays out. But in terms of Gaza, I mean, my goodness, they just had this huge operation again in the hospital in the northern part of Gaza that was just devastating to the patients, to the hospital itself. They're in this process of clearing people out. They've done everything that we've asked them not to do. They haven't done what we have asked them to do, which is, open all the gates so that all the food aid can get in. You see it still being physically blocked or minimized even to this day. So no, I don't see any evidence at all that we have any influence on Israel when it comes to Gaza.
And recently we had Donald Trump is doing many interviews and he's talking about Iran and Russia. It seems that in his mind right now, since he wants to focus on China, he says that we don't need to go to war with Iran and even with Russia. We have to put an end to the conflict in Ukraine. All I want about Iran is their nuclear program being limited. And on his pick for the vice president, J.D. Vance, in the latest interview he had, he said, we are not interested in having a war with Iran in the Middle East. Doesn't matter how much the Israelis are pushing for that.
Yeah.
And you see one side of this story, and on the other hand, you see the people they're talking about, if Donald Trump wins in 2024, Mike Pompeo, I don't know, Nikki Haley, and maybe Cotton.
Tom Cotton.
Yeah. These people are totally against what they're talking about, Biden, Donald Trump and right. J.D. Vance are talking about. How you understand Donald Trump's second term if he wins? Is he possible to implement what he's talking about right now?
Wow, that's a question I've got myself. I've seen those interviews. I've heard Trump himself in an interview say that those are some of the people he's considering for some of his top positions in the national security and foreign policy areas. And I just got to shake my head. I'm like going, gosh, which is it? Because when I hear those guys like Pompeo talking, I mean, Pompeo almost sounds, the same as some of these Israeli spokesmen in some of the ways he's talking. It's crazy, how anti-Iran he is and how pro-Israel he is. And Nikki Haley is just about as strong. And Tom Cotton hadn't met a war he didn't like already. So wow, if those are going to be some of your top lieutenants, I don't know how you're going to put a policy in that says we don't want war with Russia or Iran, which is the right call, because we do need both these wars to end as soon as possible so that we don't get drawn into a war we should never fight, that is not in our interest, and we might not even win. But that's a question that I still have, and I don't have an answer to it now about what will Trump actually do. I mean, if he brings these people in those positions, I just don't know.
And what's so amazing that Pompeo, in his latest interview with Newsweek, he said that Donald Trump doesn't know what he's talking about Ukraine. What's going on?
I missed that
one. That's just about Iran.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. If that's the case, I missed that.
Are amazing if they get into the administration, and I think we're going to have the same kind of policies that we've been witnessing during his first term.
Yeah, although honestly, I think that in my view, I think that Harris is more likely to win now, because I mean it was a coin flip before. But when you see some of the disastrous comments that came out of the Madison Square Garden event with Trump, and I'm not just talking about the Puerto Rican issue, but a bunch of other ones that happened too. And then some of Harris's recently, she last night had this big event on the mall in Washington, which was great TV imagery, and it makes her look really strong, et cetera. It was on the site of the Trump's speech on January the 6th, of, you know, that famous date there, et cetera. It just really feels like that the momentum has shifted over. And when you're talking days away from the election now, it's hard for me to see how that gets reversed. So I think it's probably going to be a Harris.
And let's assume that if she wins, the first woman being president of the United States, woman of color, and on the other hand, she has the legacy of the Biden administration, because she was part of the Biden administration. And right now, she's going to make her policies. Do you think that she's going to follow the policy of the Biden administration, or are we going to have some sort of changes, some sort of modifications in terms of what's going on in Ukraine and in the Middle East?
Well, she has implied that she is not going to just be an extension of the Biden administration, that she has her own policies, but she's been very coy about saying what those things are. Up to this point, she's been the vice president, so her job has physically been to just echo what President Biden says, because that's what you're supposed to do when you're the vice president. So we really don't know what she would say different, how much of the things that she says on both the Ukraine war and the Israelis' multiple wars, how much of that she actually means. We know what is her view, and how much is that, well, this is what I'm telling you as the president to the vice president, this is what you're going to say, et cetera. I just don't know that you can't underestimate, though, the extraordinary sway over American policy that the Israeli lobbies, the pro-Israeli lobbies have, and they have shown that they have a profound amount of power over U.S. decision makers. So they certainly wouldn't slow down with any of that. There's actually a report out this morning that's looking about how much money the Israeli lobby is putting into the campaign. And you see, it's really interesting that especially among the House and Senate races, they're giving everybody money. They just almost don't care who they give money to, as long as it's pro-Israel. They're Republican, Democrat, they could care less. So that the only time they go after somebody is when they don't do what Israel wants to do, and then they'll vote for their opponent again, no matter which party, even if it's within the Democratic Party, as they showed in two separate cases in this election cycle, where they voted out a member of the Democratic House that didn't, you know, wasn't strong enough pro-Israel. So that'll continue on, even if Harris does in fact win, regardless of what she may want to do. But the one thing, she'll have a bit of time to if she wants to push back in either place in the early, like in the first year or so, because, you know, it'll be minimum of, three more years before she would come back up for re-election. And, you know, a thousand things could change in between now and then. So sometimes you see presidents that they'll take, difficult choices and difficult actions at the early part, like Biden, for example, when he came in and actually decided to go ahead and end the Afghanistan war and knew that was going to be unpopular. It turned out to be horrifically messy and a disaster. But, you know, by the time the election comes up, no one's talking about Afghanistan anymore. I mean, they did earlier, but nobody is talking about it right now. So it would be the similar situation, an opportunity for Harris if she comes in, that, you know, she could take whatever, you know, she wants to do, and she could take some heat now because no one's going to remember it when it comes time for the next election.
Yeah, when we're talking about the Biden administration, I think mainly we're talking about Anthony Blinken and Jake Sullivan. These two are so much the face of the administration, whatever has happened in Ukraine and right now in the Middle East. In your opinion, is she going to use these people in her administration?
By all accounts of people I'm talking to here in Washington that have some knowledge about this, the consensus is that both of those guys are going to be gone, to include Secretary of Defense as well. But just kind of the way things typically work, there'll be a transition period. So I'm sure that it's possible that initially she would maintain those guys just for continuity to get stopping in. And then maybe you would have, you know, the National Security Advisor. She will replace that when, you know, maybe first, and then second, the Secretary of State. And then after that, the Secretary of Defense, it would bring a new one so that you have a smoother transition. But I mean, you never know. I mean, you know, she maybe say, no, I want a clean slate on day one, and we'll go with that. But the consensus is pretty much that those guys are on, you know, the end of their tenure one way or the other.
One of the very important variables in the calculation in the Middle East and the things that going on, the conflict between Iran and Israel, was how much Russia is supporting Iran. And we know that in the coming weeks, they're going to have a comprehensive agreement. They're going to sign a comprehensive agreement between Russia and Iran. How do you find right now the relationship between Iran and Russia, Russia and China, Russia and North Korea? Are they just forming some sort of alliance that they're not talking about it, but they're having it?
Well, you've got a continuation of what's been going on for quite a long time. You've actually had Russia, China, and Iran have done joint military maneuvers, even naval maneuvers, for a number of years now. And of course, U.S. actions in both the Ukraine-Russia war and in the Middle East has just pushed all these people together. Actions against China regarding Taiwan as well, you know, with these freedom of navigation, these, you know, kind of things going through the Strait of Taiwan. You know, all these things continue to poke in the eye of all these people. The tariffs that Trump is claiming he would do, the tariffs that are still, in fact, right now, in place, that even the Biden administration is doing. All these things keep pushing these guys further and further together. Now, Russia specifically has military agreements with both Iran and North Korea. They still have considerable help from the Chinese and dual purpose military capabilities, if not outright weapons and ammunition. And definitely on the diplomatic and economic front with the BRICS that has just concluded. And, you know, and Iran now being a part of that, everybody, China and Russia, and India, for that matter, add that into the group. They have a significant motivation to make sure Iran stays independent, that it doesn't lose its government, et cetera. And that's a real important point to make out when you're talking about Israel wanting to decapitate the government, because you have two nuclear superpowers who want to make sure that doesn't happen and would not be passive if Israel tried to do that, I don't think. So, our actions, along with Israel, continue to push all those people together. And whether there would actually be like a Warsaw Pact cop counter to what the NATO is doing, you know, some kind of a new bonding with all these groups here, or not, is unknown. But you see, there's bilateral relations with Russia, which is very, very important. And then there's huge diplomatic and economic groupings with a lot of people together and growing to some, and it continues to move the center of gravity away from the Western world. You know, so it's a very concerning development. Instead of trying to reverse some of these and give incentive for people not to move together, we just seem to be providing more incentive for them to continue on this path to our own harm. And I think that at some point, we're going to pay a real price for this, and we may look back and wish we could go back to where we are now and stop doing some of these dumb things and reverse them before permanent damage was done. But you know, arrogance and pride. I just doubt we're going to do what makes sense.
When you look at the bigger picture of the rise of BRICS, the way that Russia and China and Iran are getting together, is it going to benefit peace and benefit some sort of de-escalations in terms of the conflicts that we're witnessing right now in the Middle East, in Ukraine?
Here's what many people around the world who are not in the West or in Europe, so, you know, virtually the global South and really all the rest of the world for that matter, they see, on the one hand, they see the Western dominated world led by the United States that says we are going to provide all the ammunition and weapons and everything Ukraine needs for as long as it takes. We keep using that phrase. They want Ukraine to win the war. They want Russia to lose the war. They see the West, the United States, primarily given everything Israel wants, oblivious to this horrific human tragedy being imposed upon the Palestinian peoples in Gaza and in the West Bank and the Lebanese and southern Lebanon, or the Yemenis. And those, we don't seem to care anything about those, just more war. And we see the same thing in the Indo-Pacific area, where we keep giving Taiwan more and more weapons. We keep setting all these records for all the money we're giving them. Everywhere you see, what we do is we support more military action and weapons. Diplomacy has almost ceased to exist. Nobody's talking about trying to find a diplomatic way to anything, something for a kind of a win-win deal where everybody can have something that they need as long as we're not even attempting that. Literally, we're not even attempting that. We don't even seek that outcome. On the other hand, you do see China, who we always, you know, say is the big bully and the thing that we're supposed to be afraid of, and there's always war. What is he talking about? Other than the specific Taiwan issue, you hear him always talking about, we want to meet peace. They help broker peaceful relations between, you know, longtime enemies, Saudi Arabia and Iran. They help broker some of that. They say, we want to see an end to the Russia-Ukraine war. Even though they're friends with Russia, they're still saying, we want to see a diplomatic end to this. We want to see an end to the Middle Eastern conflicts. They want to see an end. And that was part of their declaration there, that they want a peaceful world. So when you have all these people around the world, they're looking back and they're seeing, here's the West on one side, which is committed to funding wars and keeping them going as long as possible. And then you see this other emerging bloc that says, we actually want peace. What do you think those people are going to want to do in the rest of the world? Whose vision of the world do they want? The one that says we want peace and doesn't start wars and isn't supporting wars everywhere? Or the one that actually is saying, everybody, we're going to be against you. And all we want is conflict. I mean, there's growing people even in the West that are really uncomfortable with this. And, you know, shows like ours, where we push back on this all the time and say this is counterproductive. It's not even good for us, much less for the target countries. And we should change course because peace is possible. We have a history in the past where we used a lot of diplomacy and we're exceptionally good at it. And there was a lot of peace in the world because of how we used to conduct things. But a lot of people in other parts of the world are not going to be so forgiving or patient or anything else. They're going to say, forget y'all. We're going to go over here. Our future lies with somebody that's not going to be in the wars all the time. And eventually you could get to a critical mass to where enough people feel that way that they start acting with their business and their money. And all of a sudden, all this center of gravity that's been the Western world since World War II shifts over to the East. And now all of a sudden our financial models don't work if the dollar isn't, you know, the dominant currency. And if the amount of trade, you know, starts to go down to a certain level, it can have really, really negative impact on us. And of course, instability like that often leads people to get afraid and then they choose more war. So I'm really worried about, you know, for global peace and security, how things are developing right now.
And the way that BRICS is working right now, and you look at BRICS is a family that is forming its members that, despite having their differences, they're trying to get closer, they're trying to find some sort of solution for their problems. On the other hand, you have G7. It seems that if we assume that the United States is the father of family, it doesn't care about the other members of the family. The way that Germany is just, the economy of Germany was destroyed by the conflict in Ukraine, but it doesn't seem that the United States is caring about Germany, caring about the European Union. Japan is not doing great. And do they really consider any sort of what's really is happening in the European Union? Because on the other hand, they're caring about themselves. We know that one of the most important factors that Russia could sustain, could survive these tremendous sanctions from the West, was the BRICS countries. They work together.
Yep.
And we don't see that happening in G7. It's the totally the opposite way that's happening in G7.
Yeah, I mean, I've been warning about that dynamic going on, and wondering and been really puzzled, you know, how long that can go on. I mean, there's different people that you can believe whatever you want about who actually destroyed the pipeline there, the German pipeline, you know, that was between them and Russia. But no matter who it actually was, it certainly harmed Germany more than anybody. And of course, all these sanctions that the United States has insisted upon has harmed the European Union much more than Russia, Germany in particular. But many of the countries that got a lot of the cheap energy from Russia now get much more expensive energy from elsewhere, like the United States, for example. And I've been surprised, I have to concede, that each of these countries is still seemingly continue to sacrifice their national interest in the deference to what Washington is wanting to do in a direction that can't succeed. I mean, the war is lost in Ukraine. It's done. They're still fighting, but it's a dead man. It's like the last, say, 6 months or so of World War II, where the Germans, after Stalingrad specifically, but after the Second Battle of Kursk, in particular, it was over at that point. They never recovered. And all the time it was just falling back, and they could have and should have ended the war a long time before that. But Hitler wouldn't do what made any sense. And all these people, they just kept fighting anyway. And that's what Ukraine is doing right now. But there's no rational path to even holding on to what they have as long as the war continues on. And there's zero chance, not any at all, that they could ever force Russia out. That doesn't even exist. So one wonders, then why are all these European nations making so many sacrifices for something that is self-evidently already failed and will continue? And at some point, Ukraine is just going to be collapsed. Their military, whether there's a big arrow movement that comes up and Russia launches some, you know, shock, big attack or something that finally breaks the line, or they just keep going with this methodical thing. It doesn't matter, because at some point it's inevitable the Ukraine army will just finally just collapse and they'll be defeated. And so why do I want to keep sacrificing for something that's heading towards a bad outcome? And there's no path to a good outcome. And I don't have an answer for that. I'm really surprised, especially by the Germans.
When they're talking about that Russia is using North Korean soldiers against Ukrainians, we have two concepts: that they want to warn Russia not to do that, or on the other hand, we can say that we can see it as they are preparing to send NATO troops to Ukraine to fight Russia. And what's your take on this?
Yeah, we'll look at the first half of that first of all, but the North Korean side. I am not at all convinced that Russia needs these troops. Now, there's been lots of ridicule in the West that, oh, this just shows how desperate Russia is, how horribly their personnel situation is, and they need these troops. And I'm thinking, okay, I don't see any evidence of that. On our show, the Daniel Davis Deep Dive, I had somebody who fought for the Russian side, or is fighting for the Russian side, a British citizen, actually, who went to fight, and he was in one of the higher density areas in the Kupiansk area. He's fighting for the Russians. And he said, we hear rumors about these North Koreans. We haven't seen any of them, but we have no problem with ammunition, no problem with manpower. We got all we need of everything. Everything's fine in that regard. And that matches what we've seen everywhere else. And you see, the Russian army keeps growing. Well, if they keep growing and getting better domestically, then where is this so-called desperation that they're not succeeding, when even according to the Ukrainian side, the numbers have gone up from whatever it was, like 190-something thousand at the beginning, to somewhere around 600,000 to 700,000 now, possibly even 800 by the end of the year. So where is the fundament? Where's the evidence that Russia has having any problems with manpower? Secondly, on that same topic, as someone who's fought in coalition warfare before in Desert Storm and had a lot of coordination with others in other types of military environment, it's a lot harder than it seems to plug in a foreign military into your organization here, because you have to have the language issues are a big issue by themselves. That means you got to have a lot of people on both sides of the line that speak each other's language so that you can coordinate. There's an even bigger issue with communications types, radios, ways of fighting, coordination. Flank unit coordination is incredibly important when you come into coalition warfare. It's a very difficult task. And only 10,000, 12,000 troops is what's being alleged. Now, that's nothing. In terms of a war, that's like one division or a couple of brigades, maybe. It's not going to turn the tide anywhere, and Russia doesn't need them. But even if they did need them, it's going to be a really difficult task to do all that coordination. So why is Russia going to go to the difficulties when all they have to do is send their own divisions in there to do the work at all? I think that the more likely explanation is that this is something Kim Jong-un wanted, that he wanted to take his guys who have had no combat experience for decades of any kind. They haven't fought anything. So I would imagine him wanting to send them into the Russian area to learn from the guys who are fighting modern warfare, how it works, what's called TTPs, tactics, techniques, and procedures that they have learned, you know, in combat, how their coordination, integration with electronic warfare, with drone warfare, artillery, air power, all that kind of thing, and then say, hey, let's take that back to our force, and then they'll train the trainer kind of a thing. I think that's the most likely outcome that for all this ammunition that Kim Jong-un has given to Putin, I think he said, I want more than just cash for it. I want to, you know, to help my troops out. We'll see over time. It's too early to make that conclusive, but my guess is, knowing how difficult it would be to plug them into fighting for Russia and how they don't need it anyway, the fact that they're there implies to me, I think, more that that the North Korean side is the initiator of that they want to get the combat experience for their own forces. The other half of your initial conversation or your question there is, you know, could that be used as a pretext for the NATO people to use, send forces in there? I don't think so. That's what Zelensky wants. I showed him on our show earlier today. That's exactly what he's asking. He says, this is changing tides and people need to be more alarmed and send more help right now. And I get why he's saying that, but I think genuinely most of Europe recognizing what I said a second ago, that the war is over. It's not going to be a win. So why am I going to actually send my troops in to fight a battle that they can't win and just get a bunch of people killed and raise the likelihood of a nuclear weapon being used somewhere? I don't see anybody making that kind of, even Poland, which has been the most, and the Baltics, which are the most, angst, you know, the most angry advocates for a lot of this stuff. I don't think they're going to actually do this. And the further west you go, the less likely are that anybody wants to send troops there. So I doubt that's going to happen. France has got a hothead sometimes, and you can see that somebody may be tempted to, before a collapse, to say, we're going to send some troops into Western Ukraine to train up the Ukrainians, whatever. And I think that would be a bad, bad move with no upside and lots of potential for downside.
Just to wrap up this session, what's the reason behind the way that Russia is again talking about nuclear weapons, the use of nuclear weapons?
Well, I think it could be to forestall one of the things you're thinking of, because I think Russia realizes that it's starting to get into the end game now, that this is starting to get wrapped up. And what's been allowed by all this, the slowness of the Russian advance, even though it's picked up space in the last couple of months, it has allowed the Western side to keep going with fiction that, no, we just need to give them more weapons. We just need long-range weapons. We just, you know, we need F-16s, whatever the thing is of the day. And they can keep going. They keep giving more ammunition, more weapons from the West, et cetera, but without having to worry about it escalating anywhere else. And they can keep the fiction alive that this is going to work. But if the Ukrainian army finally cracks and breaks and collapses and Russia finishes the job, then there's going to be panic in the West because they're going to think, holy crap, all this time we've been talking about how Russia's getting weaker and that they can't win and we have to make sure that Ukraine wins, et cetera. And now all of a sudden, all the fiction can no longer be maintained. And the hardcore reality that a physical defeat has taken place, that means Russia won. And there's going to be a fear of many on the West to take radical action and to maybe think about using troops, Western troops, to fight in here, whether that's on a bilateral or on a NATO case. And I think that Russia is getting ready to say, okay, let me make sure you're very clear. We will use tactical nuclear weapons. This is the third time this year they've actually physically brandished nuclear weapons in an exercise. And so I think that they know the end game is getting ready to come up. And so they want to make certain that the NATO knows that if you escalate further, we are prepared to do so. Well, that's pretty much what Putin said yesterday.
Thank you so much, Colin, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Always. Thanks a lot for having me, Neva. Yeah.